Welcome to Season 15 of the Art of Teaching podcast. I'm Matthew Green, and I'm so grateful that you've joined me today. Before we get started with our discussion, I would like to acknowledge the Dharawal people, the traditional custodians of this land on which I'm recording, and pay respect to elders past, present, and emerging. I acknowledge the stories, traditions, and living cultures of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples on this land. Today I have a very special episode for you from the phenomenal Professor Guy Claxton. He is a cognitive scientist, educational thought leader, and prolific author. He spent most of his working life at a variety of universities, including Oxford, Bristol, and King's College London. In this conversation, we talked about what it was like to have a dinner party with J.R.R. Tolkien, radically redefining intelligence and preparing young people for a learning life. I hope that you get as much out of this wide-ranging conversation as I did with the amazing Professor Guy Claxton. Professor Guy Claxton, welcome to the podcast. Thanks so much for joining me today. Where are you phoning in from?
From sunny Sussex in the southern south of England, where it's been a bit misty, but we're moving into summer, which means in England, as your listeners may know, means that the rain is getting slightly warmer.
Fantastic. And what time is it over there at the moment?
It's 8 o'clock in the evening.
Wow. I'm so grateful that you would spend some time talking to me today, Guy, and quite possibly the most important question. What's your coffee order for when I can finally nip over to Sussex?
Oh, sure. Now, that's an easy one. It's a flat white, which I think was probably invented in Australia, wasn't it?
I think so.
Accompanied by a top-of-the-range chocolate-coated ginger biscuit.
That sounds very English of you.
I'm English. What can I say?
That's right. I love that. And is there a book that you have read recently, could be within your sphere of expertise or even more broadly, that has caused you to pause and reconsider a few things in your life?
That I've read recently? I've got a kind of history of books that have steered me in different directions. What am I reading at the moment? I'm reading a lot of neuroscience. For my new book, and that's all full of surprises. So I'm reading a book by a man called Jochen Fuster at the moment. I forget the title of it, but it's all about how the brain is, how there aren't any compartments in the brain.
Wow.
The metaphor for the brain is not like a digital computer at all. It's more like the Amazon jungle or something. And we're beginning to get a sense of what the job of the brain is and to figure out some of the different pathways and mechanisms that it uses to do that job. But we're a long way from understanding it. So that's pushing me in a kind of scientific way and changing my idea, really, about what the brain is for and how it works.
Love that. And if you could have a dinner party with anybody, your family doesn't count in the head count. They are automatically there. Who would you love to sit down with and have a meal with, past or present?
Well, they're two past and one present come to mind. One of my intellectual heroes is a guy called Andy Clark, who's been very inspirational to me. And he's a slightly weird character, but I think he'd be interesting to sit down and talk with. I've never actually met him. We've corresponded. The second is a man called J.R.R. Tolkien, who I once sat next to at a dinner in Merton College, Oxford, when I was a young graduate student. I didn't know who he was at the time. I didn't know till afterwards. And I would love to have him, to bring him back from the other side of the grave and really appreciate who he is. and talk to him about his imagination. That's what I would be really interested in.
Gosh.
Imagination and his craft as a writer.
Gosh.
And the third person I'd like to have back is my 14-year-old crush, who was a pop singer called Helen Shapiro, who I wrote fan letters to, but she never replied.
Oh gosh, I have to ask, how did you feel when you found out you sat next to Tolkien?
Excited. Well, excited, and also sorry that we hadn't had longer and I'd kind of missed my opportunity to pick his brains. It was at a very stuffy dinner with all the fellows of Merton College, who were all talking about very erudite, arsy subjects. And this little old man I was sitting next to, he engaged me in a very enthusiastic conversation about the quality of different chocolate puddings that we had encountered in our life. Gosh. And I thought what a nice old chap he was. And then I realized that he was a whole lot more than a nice old chap, but I'd missed my chance.
Gosh, that is an incredible story, and what a wonderful dinner party that would be.
Yeah, it would be good.
Just wondering, Guy, what's something that you are most grateful for from your parents?
Oh, my education, without a doubt. We were not a well-off family at all. My dad was just a bank clerk. My mum was a music teacher. And they made significant sacrifices to send me to a good school, where I was a very mediocre student up until the exams that we did when we were 16. And then I kind of discovered that it was possible for me to be successful. I hadn't really thought academically successful. I hadn't really thought of that before.
Mm-hmm.
And then to get to Cambridge and then to Oxford and then to all the different university that I've worked in, without the sacrifices that I made. My mum gave up smoking in order to help to finance my school, which was a major sacrifice for her in those days. So, yeah, thank you, Mum and Dad. They both passed away, but I'm eternally grateful to them.
That's really wonderful. And, I mean, what an achievement to go from somebody who didn't see themselves as particularly academic to an incredibly an amazing career, and especially attending Cambridge and Oxford. I mean, what was that like back when you were a student? Well,
it was interesting. This experience that I had when I was about 16 or 17 was sort of one of the foundations of my changing understanding of what intelligence is, because I no longer think of it as kind of IQ and largely genetically determined. It was because I surprised myself and everybody else by doing well in those exams, that I think at some not very conscious level, I decided to be bright.
Wow.
That it was worth investing in that form of expertise. And I see the new book that I'm writing at the moment is an attempt to rescue the notion of intelligence from being too tightly bound up with the idea of intellect or scholarship. I think that's been a big mistake and has done unfortunate damage to lots of people who are incredibly bright but just not very scholarly.
Mm. Absolutely. I mean, Guy, that's a huge point, and I'm sure we could have a podcast episode in itself on that very right. point. And I do think of the amount of children that are sitting in classrooms now that have always considered themselves as unintelligent, and it really does sadden me. And I love that your notion of intelligence is so much more broader than I think what traditional notions are.
Yeah, I wrote a book about 8 years ago called Intelligence in the Flesh.
Yeah,
which was the kind of grounding. I don't know if you've come across that one. I know you've done your groundwork on me pretty well. Which sort of brings together a lot of the science behind this changing notion. And the new book, which I think is going to be called Bodies of Learning, is pulling out all the implications, and I think they're quite radical, of this shifting view of intelligence is one of the core cornerstones, if you like, on which the whole building, the whole edifice of education has been built. Intelligence, memory, thinking, knowledge, and one other. I forget what. There are five cornerstones.
Yeah.
And the science is giving us cause to radically rethink our understanding of those five key notions and the foundations of traditional education, conventional education, will really crumble over the next few years in the light of this new, these new understandings.
Yeah, yeah, I couldn't agree more, Guy. And just before we move on to your incredible work, 38 books. I thought I was busy, but how on earth do you find the time to write 38 books and still have some sort of a life?
Well, I like writing. It's my, a lot of people find writing difficult, but I've always enjoyed writing from when I was at school. And I was all set when I went to university to read chemistry and be a chemistry teacher. And I did suffered 2 years of undergraduate chemistry teaching, which became increasingly arduous and boring and unfruitful for me. So much to my mother's disappointment, I gave up on being a chemistry teacher and hopped over to psychology, where you could write, you could argue, you could think, you could use metaphors, where there were lots of things that were unknown rather than just having to mug up lots of things that were already known. It's been a bit of a journey, that.
Fantastic. And tell me about the Little Ed book of education. Yeah, tell me about that.
That's right, which is the Little Red Book, was Chairman Mao's book of wit and wisdom in China, revolutionary China, back in the 1950s or 60s. So when I put that book together, that was my very first book, the Little Ed book. It was a sort of riff on his book. But it was nothing to do with kind of communism. I just started working in education. I got my first job. I was going to be a lecturer in straight psychology after I finished my undergraduate studies and my postgraduate studies as well, my DPhil. And I was looking around for a job. I nearly got a job in the USA. I just was narrowly pipped to that by someone else. And then I got a job working at the Institute of Education in London.
Wow.
And I was new to education, although I'd been interested in it. I'd been to some workshops at Oxford, which were very stimulating. And I found myself working with people who were training to be teachers and developing my ideas about what that meant, what it was like. The subtitle for the Little Ed book was, "Teaching is not just a job, it's a new way of being yourself." And it was the ethos of that book was that a lot of people find it difficult to be themselves in the classroom. They feel they have to fake it.
Wow.
Or to create a stricter or more severe or more knowledgeable persona when they're standing up in front of the class. So this was a more humanistic or more holistic view of how to be a teacher. And I just kind of, you know, photocopied it and distributed it to some of my students to see what they thought. And the next thing I knew was I got a letter out of the blue from a publisher who said, you know, "I've got hold of this and we think it's pretty cute. And if you're ever looking for a professional publisher, we'll gladly take it on."
Yeah.
So my first experience of writing and getting a book published was as easy as that. And that, I think, kind of changed my mindset about writing. So I've written a fair few journal articles in my time, but mostly I want to write books that people, not just purely academic books, but books that bring ideas to a more general audience. And what audience could be more important than teachers?
I love that. And tell me a little bit, Guy, about your writing process. I mean, what does it look like? How do you find the time? How do you structure your day? Are you just constantly?
If I could show you around my office, you would see that it's a very messy and organic process. Because I'm looking around, there are piles of books. There are post-it notes stuck everywhere. There's a advertising notice board in front of me with drafts of the chapters around. So it's very organic. and a bit haphazard, but gradually something comes together. I rely on my unconscious a lot. I don't, but I do a lot of reading, a lot of collecting of notes, a lot of what I call fondly gathering my nesting material. And then slowly some of this begins to form itself into the shape that I want it to be in.
Lovely.
And that's how it goes. Then I sit down to write. And people say, people who like my writing say it's as if I was talking to them. And that's, and I like that. I like that feel of not being too academic, not being too formal, too austere, or too forbidding in my writing. I like to write about thorny issues and intricate scientific ideas, but to do it in a way with some humor and metaphors which make the writing tasty. So there's a lot of creativity in the moment as I sit here. It's almost as if I'm talking to myself, or as if my brain is dictating the writing to me, rather than sitting down with a very carefully woven plan and following that, knowing I've got to do 250 words on this and 50 words on that. Da, da, da,
Love
da.
that.
So it's an organic process.
So, would you say that you are not an advocate for the current trend of minimalism when it comes to your office space?
Certainly not. Certainly, my wife is also writing a book at the moment. Her office is much more minimal and tidy than mine. And I wouldn't really advocate one way or the other. I think, you know, after 50 years of being a writer, I do what sort of works for me. And
Fantastic.
other people have different. If you look at the kind of autobiographies of writers, the way they write is incredibly different, and it works. Different ways work for different people.
Yeah, I love that. I love that there's no set way of approaching it, and that the creative process is so different for so many people. It's really reassuring to hear that, because I think sometimes we think it's a one size fits all approach, but that's clearly not the case.
Not at all. The one thing I would say is, and I'm talking to Jude, my wife, about this, that it's important to be both to let the writing happen, and then you also need to be an editor and a critic of your own writing. I've just been back in Oxford at a talking to a conference of head teachers. And in my spare time, I went to a great exhibit at one of the great old libraries in Oxford called the Bodleian Library, which is an exhibition of the drafting and redrafting process of writers down the ages, going all the way back to 14th century medieval Christian manuscripts through to the writings of Virginia Woolf and John le Carré.
Wow.
These days. And I love looking at the messiness of people's writing.
I
You
love
know,
that.
look at the recent lovely book produced by Paul McCartney about the drafts and the where they got the ideas from for Eleanor Rigby or Penny Lane,
I love
and the messy process. And we don't convey the truth of learning to kids as much as we should. I think we should bring some of that messiness. Or sometimes we convey to kids the idea that if you're bright enough, that somehow an excellent product springs instantaneously out of your mind. That if you were, you know, if you were bright enough, you wouldn't have to draft and redraft. You wouldn't make mistakes. You wouldn't have to rub things out. You wouldn't have to ask your friends for help.
I
And I
love
don't
that.
know anybody whose writing is like that. We all have to go back. So I love the kind of looking at the John le Carré actually physically cutting out, snipping out bits of his drafts and stapling them back together in
It's
different
beautiful.
configurations.
I don't know if you've had the privilege, Guy, of going to the Picasso Museum in Paris, but it is wonderful. Have you been there?
I don't think I've been to Paris. I remember going, having a wonderful visit to the Rodin Gallery, but Picasso has museums all over the place, and I
Sure.
have one. He spent some time. He may even have been born in Malaga in Spain, and they have a very nice little exhibition
Yeah.
museum there of
It
his works, which I've enjoyed.
It's really wonderful because in the museum in Paris, you get to see his studio, and you get to see his writing process, and just the volume of work that he produced is really outstanding. There's all these wonderful little snippets of from his sketchbooks and paintings that didn't work out well, and it was a reminder, I think, to me that the creative process is actually very formative and even quite messy at times. It was really
Absolutely.
wonderful.
Absolutely. Why don't we do that in schools? It's like, the rough work is something that you only do if you have to, and you throw it away as soon as you've done it. But if you look at the heritage of Beethoven's rough work or Einstein's rough work, it's fascinating. And we ought to bring this into the classroom so that kids learn to see the learning, the creative learning that produces anything worthwhile is laborious and tentative and iterative, that you go around and you improve. I mean, every time I give a new talk, I drag out an old PowerPoint presentation, but there's always something new. There's always some modification, some tweaking,
Love that.
some tinkering with it that I'm moved to do. And then that stimulates my own understanding and my own thinking process. So we should, why don't we bring that into school? Why don't we make that front and center of everything that they're doing, so they get a realistic sense of the lovely labor of creating?
Yeah, I love that. And I heard a quote somewhere, and forgive me for not knowing where, but it was talking about if you are not embarrassed by your first draft, you've waited too long. And I've always loved
That's
that because
right.
I look back at even take, for example, this podcast. I look back at many, I think about 3 years ago, I started a podcast with actually with some of your had some of your colleagues, Dylan on, Professor John Hattie. And I listened to some of those early episodes and go, oh, I'm a bit embarrassed that I didn't ask a question that I wanted to ask. I'm a bit embarrassed at the audio quality, but I think it's a good reminder just to get started and to embrace that messiness. I think it's really
Sure.
important.
Well, I'm delighted that you've been slowly working your way up the educational food chain and you finally arrived at me. That's wonderful. I've been waiting for you.
Fantastic. Thank you. Guy, is there something that you have changed your mind about?
Well, we've already mentioned the notion of intelligence, which I think is really, really important. So when I started out with the conventional view of intelligence as largely genetically determined and largely to do with IQ, and that means being able to solve tricky little abstract problems that have no bearing on your real life, usually in a strange room under intense time pressure, as if that was somehow prototypical of all the intelligence that we need to have. And real life intelligence, just it's so not like that. It is messy, it is organic, it is embodied, it is collective, it is malleable. A lot of my work has been around, one of the ways of framing my work in education and in cognitive science as well, has been exploring the non-intellectual, non-deliberate, non-rational forms of intelligence which we possess, but which are ignored and therefore disregarded, therefore suppressed by education. So that would be the main thing for me.
I
It's
love that.
mostly things, but mostly the things I've changed my mind about, and I'm changing my mind all the time. Otherwise, I don't want my mind to go stale. I'm nearly 77 and still learning like crazy and still making mistakes.
And is there something, Guy, that you are currently trying to become better at? Is there a hobby? Is there a skill? Is there some way that you put yourself out of your comfort zone to feel that thrill of being a beginner again?
I'm a bit of a one-trick pony, so it's mostly I'm constantly trying to get better at writing.
Don't have any hobbies?
Not really. I'm
Maybe.
getting better at get I am slowly getting better at gardening, but only under duress. My wife is a very keen and very expert gardener. She's from Northern Ireland. Every so often, quite frequently, she goes over to spend time with her mum, She's there at the moment. It's her mum's 90th birthday tomorrow.
Gosh.
Leaving me in charge of the greenhouse. And this is very stressful activity for me and for her, because she quite rightly doesn't trust me to do all the things that she does instinctively correctly. And it's springtime here, so the greenhouse is full of precious, tender little seedlings, which could dry out at any moment, or could be overwatered, or could be attacked by slugs or occasionally mice. So I am nervously and anxiously seeing if I can, under her somewhat impatient instruction, I have to say, if I can improve as rapidly as possible in knowing when to water and how much to water.
Love that.
And at what time of night you have to go out with your iPhone and see if you can start picking the slugs, greedy little bastards, off the fresh young leaves, which they love so much. So I'm an apprentice gardener, reluctant and not very good at it.
It's a lot of pressure, isn't it?
It is. I don't like it.
So, Guy, what is
the good side of it is when she goes away, I have complete control of the remote.
Hopefully she's not listening to this podcast when it goes out.
I think it's unlikely.
So, Guy, what's the point of school, or what should be the point of school? I mean, you've written a whole book on this.
One of my more successful books. We thought long and hard about the title, and then someone said, "Well, what's the book actually about?" And I said, "What's the point of school?" I was going to call it, when I was casting around for the title, I was staying with a friend of mine, professor of theatre in Bristol, and he was driving me into work, and his 10-year-old son was sitting in the back of the car as we were going to drop him off at school on the way. And I was talking about this book, and I was writing a book about education, and I couldn't think of the title. And I asked, I forget his name now, I asked the son what he thought would be a good title for a book. And he said, "Yeah, call it School Sucks." So I didn't call it School Sucks in the end, but that's a lot of young people's opinion of school.
It's sad, isn't it?
So what's the point of school? There are lots of different reasons, some of them good and some of them bad, and a complex mix of things. But the one that I like best is to prepare you for a learning life, really. That it's about giving you the mental, helping you grow or cultivate the mental resources to be able to follow your dreams, to find and follow your element, as the late great Sir Ken Robinson used to put it, and to have the resilience and the smarts to be able to go about living what you consider to be a challenging but worthwhile life.
Mm. So nothing to do with standardized testing, I assume?
No, not a lot to do with standardized testing. I'm all in favor of reforming assessment.
Yeah.
Because it's like, we're not going to get very far unless we do reform. There's a very, very powerful reform movement called Rethinking Assessment in the UK at the moment. And it's true that we won't get wholesale change until assessment gets changed, because as we say, the tail of the dog, tail of the assessment is the tail that wags the dog. The tail of assessment wags the dog of learning.
Yeah.
Is what I'm trying to remember. So it drives it. It's like, by the time kids get to be halfway up secondary school, the only question they ask anymore is this going to be on the exam biz?
Mm. So, Guy, I'm just wondering, because like so many experts around the world that I've spoken to, many of them, I'm sure, are your colleagues, are all saying the same thing. But yet, across nations, we seem to be getting this wrong. Why can't we figure out how to rethink schools? Because it seems like the evidence is telling us one thing, but it's just not happening. So what on earth can we do?
It's happening in lots of schools all over the place, sometimes to a very great extent. Sometimes it's patchy. Sometimes it's only in the odd classroom. But as somebody famous said, the future is already here. It's just very unevenly distributed. But there is lots of proof of concept like, you know, various schools in and around Sydney that I could name. Rooty Hill, I don't know if you know Rooty Hill.
I do.
Or I don't know. I mean, this, the things come and go. The trouble is they're like my wife's seedlings. They kind of, they, you know, innovations shoot up, but often, you know, when the weather changes or when the school principal leaves, things can easily regress. So there's a kind of, we're in a kind of fragile, what the biologists call pioneer ecosystem, which like lots of new growth trying to grow, but it's fragile and competitive, and it hasn't broken through into the mainstream yet. And that's the problem that you're alluding to and that I share with you, Matthew. It's like, how do we scale this up? And I think one of the prompts for the new book, The Bodies of Learning book, was the realization that there are some really deep-seated mind worms that people have that are in people's brains that stop them taking this stuff seriously or that make it seem more risky. Unfortunately, many of the people who are most badly infected by these mind worms rise to high levels of responsibility and power in the education system. So they become, but certainly in the UK, that's true, but particularly in England. England is one of the most backward countries educationally in the planet, I think. There are lots of countries that I don't know about, but certainly in the OECD, there is such a strong pushback from people who went to school once and therefore think that they're experts about it. And one of the key blockers, so I'm very interested in what these barriers are, what these unearthed, unrecognized mental barriers are that stop people going, well, yes, of course. And not only it's a good idea, but we can and we should do it. One of the barriers is the mind-body split. Is I'm back to this theme that if we think of mind as only cerebral, only intellectual, then that's a real, and the body is secondary and menial and a nuisance, you know, that emotions are only relevant in school when they're getting in the way. All of the corollaries of the mind-body split, while that belief system is still in place, that somehow the smarter you are means the better you are, the higher IQ, the more abstract, the more abstract your thinking is. While that beliefs, that buried belief system persists, there will always continue to be this clinging to, you know, old tests of knowledge and to a curriculum, which my old friend, one of my educational heroes and mentors is David Perkins from Harvard University, that he, what he talks about, education is bedeviled by the, by what he calls aboutism. That it's like the only thing we do in schools, apart from literacy and numeracy of very limited kinds, is talk, think, and learn about things. Whereas I think education should be about learning to do things, that competence should trump comprehension, if you like. And then we've got stuck in a world of words and explanations and articulate thoughts and writing A-grade little essays. Whereas the life that we live is not about that. It's about competence and character. And we should be emphasizing, we should leapfrog the development of competences and character above the comprehension and the understanding, and the, let alone the retention and the rote learning and all of that stuff. So when people talk about a knowledge-rich curriculum, I'm not against that. But the knowledge-stuffed curriculum, the knowledge-packed curriculum, the knowledge-choked curriculum is devilish in education, because particularly because the presumption behind that is that these more malleable, these more valuable attributes like character, like the epistemic character, like how do you cope in uncertainty when the world goes crazy on you? When you're confronted with new things, that is one of the most powerful, that learning to learn ability is one of the most powerful predictors of success in life.
Yeah.
And if that, all that gets poo-pooed and pushed out of by what I call in the Future of Teaching book, the DICA lobbies, which that DICA stands for Direct Instruction / Knowledge Rich. Nothing against knowledge at all, but it needs to be put back in its place. It has a place, but not if it functions like the cuckoo in the nest and kicks out the more valuable chicks of education. Then we're left with a terrible system, which we still have in many places, and which a number of misguided people are still robustly and aggressively defending. And that's the biggest problem, I think. We need to somehow get over that.
Yeah. I think it's just become that ever so much more personal for me, because I've got a little, I've got a daughter who's just entered year one. And it's become a bit more personal for me, I think, because she is now sort of quote unquote in the system. Yes. And can you relate to that at all?
Yes, absolutely. Not directly, because I don't have my own children. I have much loved nephews and nieces. Co-writer, co-author on the new Bodies of Learning book, Emily Poole, her name is, who's a great, I'm delighted to have found her. She's a wonderful collaborator for me, has a five-year-old who I've met, who's also very cute, very bright. And they are going, Emily and her family are going through the same issues at the moment and very worried that school is not going to be the right place to nurture the all the wonderful qualities of playfulness and creativity,
absolutely,
and quirkiness and spontaneity, which their child has by the bucket load, and which for many kids in many schools, that gets squeezed out of them.
Yeah,
it's like there's this wonderful old bit of research, and I couldn't cite the reference for you, that says in the weeks before they start primary school, kids ask about 200 questions a week, and after 3 weeks in primary school, they ask three.
Sad, isn't it?
I don't know if that's literally true, but it's, you know, something. It makes the point.
Yeah. So, Guy, tell me about learning power. And what is the learning power approach? I remember reading it in your book going, finally, somebody is talking about this.
Well, back in 2002, I wrote a book called Building Learning Power, which was my first practical attempt to move the science of learnable learning. The idea that learning itself is a craft, it's skill-based and also attitude-based. There's some combination of skills and attitudes lie behind your ability to be good with uncertainty, good with complexity. A friend of mine once said, in schools, we ought to be teaching kids how to be uncertain without becoming insecure.
I love that.
Which I thought was a very lovely way of summing it up.
Yeah.
And we now know that IQ is irrelevant to that potent mixture of real world intelligence and learning to learn, and we know that these characteristics are malleable. There's been a big sea change in the science of personality and intelligence over the last few years towards realizing just how much, not all, but just how much of personality and intelligence both are malleable, are reflections of the values and the embedded habits that characterize the environments that we find ourselves in when we're young.
Yeah, yeah.
And the three most important ones are your family, your friendship group, and your school. 15,000 of those young hours are spent awake, mostly in school. We have a huge opportunity and responsibility to shape those habits of mind, not just to fill minds with knowledge, important though some of that is, but the actual mind shaping or mind coaching. So the idea of learning power, which I first floated in that 2002 book, was my own attempt to put a grasp on this. But as always happens, you discover there are all kinds of other people all around the world who are developing similar things at a similar time. A lot of them were being bred in Project Zero at Harvard, a lot of them under the guise of David Perkins. So influential, now very influential educators, like they're often called Ron Berger, and his what he calls now the EL education schools are wonderful models of how you can get high levels of intellectual achievement and the development of powerful learning habits
I
at the
love
same time. We have to get beyond that line that a lot of people are still peddling, some of them in your city, I have to say,
that.
that line that there's some kind of the metaphor that connects learning skills with learning content is that of a tug of war, that there's some kind of contest, that there's a zero-sum game going on between are we going to teach knowledge and rigor and grades, or are we going to develop resilience and resourcefulness and reflectiveness and collaborativeness and imaginativeness and intellectual humility and flexibility of mind and fluid intelligence. And all of these things are capable of deliberate cultivation. And if we set these up as in opposition, we're doomed. So all these other different groups around the world, I realized that I was pioneering these ideas in my own little world, but that I needed to join up with a lot of other people. So I stopped
Amazing.
being Mr. Building Learning Power and started talking about the learning power approach, which I see as a emerging school of thought about the possibility, this is one way I put it now, Matthew, of knitting together more tightly a clearer vision of the point of school, which is to cultivate these mindsets or attributes or habits of mind or life skills or whatever you like to call them, who go by lots of different names, knitting that vision, which is very possible and very desirable, together with the minutiae of classroom practice. And we haven't done that very well in schools before. A very strong model which says, and the reason why I'm not going to let you use your erasers in my lessons is because erasers can encourage a feeling of shamefulness about mistakes, and that will hold you back as a learner. So we're going to practice honoring our mistakes and seeing them as stepping stones towards mastery and excellence, rather than treating them as potentially little unfortunate leakages of incompetence out into the world, which is going to make us feel inadequate. So I love the idea of what we call the golden strands that connect those little details of what's going on in the classroom, how we configure our classroom, even things that teachers may not have realized that they've been doing, so that the classroom becomes an intentional but largely implicit incubator of these learning habits. That's in a nutshell, that's what the learning power approach is. It's that mixture of science, philosophy, ethics, and really grassroots, down and dirty practicalities about what we do and don't do in our classroom.
So, Guy, what is the point of assessment and what should we be assessing, if anything?
I have a rather radical and simple solution to the problem of assessment, and it is a problem, because while we continue to have knowledge-based high-stakes tests, they will drive what busy, hardworking teachers and school principals think is what's possible and what's desirable in school. Getting grades, university entrance, are not negligible outcomes of school, but they shouldn't be the only thing that runs what's going on in school. So my solution is this: abolish all high-stakes testing and place the onus of assessment at the entry points subsequent to school rather than the exit point from school. So it should be the job of universities that, as for example, the University of Cambridge did recently. They've abandoned it in the last year or two, but I don't know why. They set their own entrance exam called the pre-U exam, and kids who wanted to go there would sit the pre-U. So it seems to me to make much more sense to put the point of assessment at the entry point to a job or to a business. If you want to know if someone can write or can digest information, sit them in a room on their own with something they haven't seen before and get them to do it for 20 minutes. you'll soon find out their level of literacy, their level of numeracy, whether they can gut a short article and pick out the main points. It was not difficult. It's not very time intensive. You could even find ways of doing it online, but it has to be something unseen, something you can't have been prepped for. And likewise, entrance to universities.
Yeah.
So I think we would solve a huge problem, the problem of innovation in education, by creating another huge problem, which is all the teachers are going to rise up in arms and say, well, what am I teaching for then? So they all then have to start teaching differently, because now they're life mind coaches rather than exam passing gurus or machines.
That's so incredibly important, and it's really wonderful to see incredible institutions like Cambridge at least trialing things like that. I think is really, really
important. And I think there will be one of the pressure points here will be high status businesses. So there are lots of businesses now, including Google, a lot of the big, what do you call them, like consultancy or accountancy business like PwC or EY or Deloitte, have been experimenting seriously with not taking into account educational qualifications in their hiring process. So you're not allowed, I don't know if this is still the case, if you're applying for a job with Google or Deloitte, there was a period, and I hope they're continuing it, where you may not tell them what your grades were at school, what university you went to, or what class of degree you got, because they think they have discovered, their hard-nosed businesses, that the kind of intelligence that gets you those grades is different from the kind of intelligence that they want in their people. So I think it's a bit of a marketplace. I think if that catches on more, if more employers realize that university grades are not the best predictors of the bright young things that they want in their business, then that will backwash onto universities and onto schools. But it's not going to happen tomorrow, I'm afraid.
That's really important, I think, Guy. And like, as I said, it's really wonderful to see these big organizations and institutions at least starting to recognize these different notions of creativity. And would you mind unpacking maybe the difference between big C creativity and small C creativity, and how on earth do we begin to cultivate this in our classrooms?
You have to have freedom and responsibility. You have to have another C, which is curiosity. But real creativity is something that's got inside you. It's an itch that you want to scratch. That was what made Picasso keep painting and repainting. It's like there was something in him that needed to be said that he didn't yet have the tools to do easily and reliably. And that's the wellspring of creativity. You want to make people laugh. I've done some work over the years with John Cleese, who's a great expert, has become a great expert on creativity. He got hold of an earlier book of mine called Harebrained Tortoise Mind, which he very kindly described in an interview that he did with Newsweek in America as the essential guide to creativity. And we've talked a lot about these things and about how important it is to protect, to have space, time, and quietness to protect the ability of your mind, to allow your mind to bubble up with ideas that are fresh or unconventional. I was once in a little secondary school, a little primary school in Wales. I did a lot of work in South Wales a while ago. And I went into a classroom that I'd been working with, and the teacher had created a little cave in the corner of the classroom. It was a year two class, with a sign above it that said Creativity Corner. And it was made out of broomsticks propped up and little black sheets, and had some little fairy lights in it. And I said to a six-year-old, what's that for? And she said, it's like when you want to do something creative, like paint a picture or write a poem or something. She said, you can just go and crawl into the creativity for a while and have time to let your brain cool down a bit so that it can bubble up with new ideas.
That's really beautiful.
And that's the John Cleese and the Guy Claxton image of creativity. I wrote this book called Hare Brain, Tortoise Mind. The hare brain is always running around busily searching for things, and the tortoise mind takes its time. And John Cleese came up with this idea of what he called tortoise enclosures, that we need to be ruthless about protecting ourselves from all the other busy work of jobs and family and daughters who are awake early in the morning, and creating those times when we can let our brains cool down and bubble up with new ideas. Schools are so busy. How long do teachers wait after asking a question before they fill the gap? 2 seconds. 2 seconds is not enough, and not enough for creativity to start incubating. So we need more silence, more quiet time, more thinking time.
I have to ask you, Guy, because I'm such a fan of John Cleese. What is he like?
Well, he's become a bit of a pompous and grumpy old man, but I still like his willingness to be creative, to be disruptive. He's got in with some bad company recently, I think. I did a program. He asked me to do an interview with him on a program in Great Britain called GB News, which is pretty right wing. And I wouldn't normally be seen dead there. But John's been given the opportunity to create a series of slightly disruptive programs. And we had a good conversation about the importance of, for education and also for business, of creating this space for people to think. But we're all so busy, all so purposeful, that we need. And he said to me, that's why I got the idea in one of my books, that whenever we're faced with a complex decision, the first question we have to ask ourselves is, when does this decision have to be made? And you don't make it until then.
Yeah.
Because if you make your decision out of the need to be decisive, you're just going to foreclose on the possibility of new thoughts, new ideas, new information coming along. It's a form of stupidity, that kind of manic decisiveness, which unfortunately is what a lot of educational organizations and a lot of businesses run on. We want decisive people who can just click their fingers and come up with a slick response to everything. But we need a bit more slow thinking. There are schools in England that used to use the word slow as a euphemism for stupid. Gosh. Or unintelligent.
Shocking.
Now, what a stupid idea is that? To stigmatize the idea of slowness, to never allow a child, when you ask a question in a classroom, you want children to be able to say in all seriousness, I don't know at the moment, sir, but could I go away and think about it and come back and we'll have another conversation about it tomorrow? That would be intelligent.
Absolutely. I want to be respectful of your time, Guy. I'm aware it's getting very late where you are. And I also, as you can see, have a little one that has woken up and is trying to...
You do indeed. A small disruptive influence who looks delightful.
She is delightful. She is absolutely delightful. But just a couple of closing questions, if that's okay. What advice would you give to educators that are in the classroom now that really want to try and cultivate more of that, those creative experiences for their children? What can they do to help drive that?
Buy my books.
Great point.
Because they're first, the suite of books that we produced a few years ago in collaboration with real classroom teachers and real head teachers, the Learning Power Approach suite, have a general book. And then there's a workbook for primary teachers, a workbook for secondary teachers, and a workbook for school leaders about how to create a whole culture of learning power in your school. But there are all kinds of, the most important thing is, I mean, you look at those books and there are all kinds of small little ideas, like banning erasers, like changing your language a little bit, like rearranging the furniture, like putting your teacher's desk at the back of the room rather than the front of the room and seeing what difference that makes. The important thing is, my message to any teacher listening to this, unless it's a Saturday or a Sunday, when you go into school tomorrow, do something a little bit different. Learn to be experimental, to see your life in the classroom as a succession of small experiments and risks, and tell the kids what you're up to and why you're doing it. But you want to become an even better teacher, and that involves taking little risks. Don't disrupt the whole thing, because then people will get upset or anxious or disaffected with what you're doing. But just like little steps to try things out. I always think what teachers should be doing is thinking of their career as like making mayonnaise. Not many people make their own mayonnaise these days, but if you do, you put some stuff in the bottom of a bowl and you add one drop of oil and you whisk it until it's thoroughly mixed in, and then you add another drop of oil, and then and whisk that in, and then another drop of oil. And the change in classrooms that is the only possible form of revolution in education is for all existing teachers to have that mindset. It's like, what's the little drop of oil that I'm going to try and whisk in to my everyday practice in the classroom? Change the way I display children's work on the wall. Have a Friday afternoon, have a competition for the kids to have their mistake acknowledged as mistake of the week, so that making mistakes is seen as being something valuable and intrinsic, and so on and so on. We have dozens and dozens of these cute little things that any teacher could try tomorrow. So please do, because if we only just sit and think about education or complain about education or wish about education, nothing is going to change. We have to behave differently a little bit every day, cumulatively, and in a year's time, massive change will have happened.
I love that. Guy, it has been an absolute joy to speak to you this morning, this evening, wherever you're listening, phoning from. Thank you so much for your time and your commitment and your dedication to a wonderful profession. I can't thank you enough for talking to me today, and thank you so much.
It's been a real pleasure, and I'd like to also honor and acknowledge teachers who are listening to this and devoting their off time to listening to this podcast. They must be also on that kind of, you know, I'm a learning teacher road. So yes, gather ideas from wherever you can, from the teacher in the next door classroom, and whatever strikes you with that, oh, that's cool. Well, the next time you go in front of a bunch of kids, try it out. When teachers say that's cool, it means I see the point and I could do it with my kids. So be on the lookout for those little things, and we will have a rapid evolution, not a revolution, but a rapid evolution in the direction of something that can hold its head up and call itself with pride a 21st century school.
Professor Guy Claxton, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks, Matthew.
Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to the podcast episode today. It's a privilege to get to share these conversations with you and continue to invest into our incredible profession. If you have a few moments, please do me a favor and leave a review on iTunes, Spotify, or through whichever platform you're listening today. If you wouldn't mind also hitting the subscribe button and sharing it with your networks, it would really help to get the word out to as many educators as possible. There are different ways to connect in the notes below, including links to the website, the Facebook group, Twitter, and Instagram. Thank you again for taking the time to listen. It means the world.